Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Chem Talk podcast. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Devlina Samanta, an assistant professor of chemistry at the University of Texas at Austin. She repurposes DNA to make complex chemical structures to detect and treat diseases. She's especially interested in proteases and how studying them can help detect tumors that are 10 times smaller than can be detected through traditional methods such as CT scans. Hi, Dr. Samanta. Thank you so much for speaking with me today on the Chem Talk podcast. You are at the University of Austin, Texas, studying what looks to be DNA and enzymes. So can you give a little introduction of yourself and what you're currently doing at your job?
Yeah, sure. So I am an assistant professor in the Department of Chemistry at the University of Texas at Austin. And what my group does is we use DNA to make new types of materials. Now, you have probably heard of DNA in the context of biology. So you probably know that DNA can be used as the building block of biology. Mm-hmm. But what we do is we repurpose DNA and then use it as a material to build different types of chemical structures that can then be used to target biology, so that we can detect and treat diseases better.
Wow. And what is the difference in these structures that you're building from DNA?
So if you think about what DNA looks like, mm-hmm. right, you're probably familiar with the cartoon structure of DNA. So you probably know that, you know, it's like a double helix, looks like sort of like a ladder, right? So this is sort of the structure of DNA that you're familiar with, right? Mm-hmm. Now, it turns out you can do a lot of cool stuff with DNA. One of the cool stuff is you can take these double strands, and if you heat up the DNA, it melts, meaning the two strands separate, okay? And now when you have, so if you have single strands of DNA, turns out because you have this very specific interactions in DNA bases, like where A binds to T and G binds to C, you can actually design sequences that will fold onto themselves, and then they can form all kinds of structures. So you can actually design DNA sequences that you can then fold and then kind of hold into position using what are called staple strands to make structures of arbitrary complexity. Mm-hmm. Examples being you can make a smiley face completely out of DNA. Oh, wow. People have made a map of the Americas completely out of DNA.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so you can basically take a long piece of DNA, fold it, and make all different kinds of structures that you want to. So that's sort of one, you know, area of modern chemical research concerning DNA materials. Another thing that you can do is, so when you, you know, think about making materials, one of the first thing many children learn is you can start to make bigger structures out of Legos, mm-hmm. right? So similarly, what you can do is when you have a material, it is actually made together or put together atom by atom, right? So what you can do is you can take, let's say, a very tiny particle, which we called a nanoparticle, mm-hmm. and you can put DNA on the surface. And here, DNA looks like a glue. So you can take two different particles that have complementary DNA. So we know that if you have complementary DNA, they come together and form the double helix, right? Mm-hmm. So just imagine that you have single strands of DNA on small particles. And just like nanoscale, just like Legos, you can actually put these particles together and start to make materials from the bottom up. And because you're using DNA, you can put these materials together in a very, very predictable manner. So you can predict what kind of structures they're going to form. So this kind of new area in chemistry has really led to the discovery of materials that have properties like no material that's naturally found on Earth. So that's pretty cool, right?
That is so cool. And what are these properties that aren't similar to what we have on Earth?
So it really depends on, once again, what the structure is. Mm-hmm. So one of the biggest examples of how structure affects materials is, so we learn in high school that it is the composition of material that determines what the material properties are, right? So sugar is sweet and salt is salty, that's because they have different compositions, right? Mm-hmm. We also learn that the structure is important. For example, graphite and diamond, both are entirely made of carbon, but graphite is very slippery, very soft material, whereas diamond is one of the hardest materials known to man, right? And that is because of the way the carbon atoms bind to another in three-dimensional space. That is what's different between these two. So similarly, when you make DNA-based structures, what the structures look like at your molecular level is going to determine what properties you see. So in one example, so this is an example, I mentioned this example because that's something we use in our lab. So DNA and proteins, these kind of things, don't enter your cells in high quantities, okay? And that's for good reason, because if you have foreign DNA in your body, in your bloodstream, that means you have an infection. So your body is kind of made in a way so that these kind of DNA will not go into the cells very easily. And the second thing is your body has these enzymes that will rapidly chop up these DNA, okay? And this is to protect you from infections and such, mm-hmm. right? But you have heard about these, you know, this gene therapy and stuff like that, right? Being able to edit genes and things. Well, those things can't work unless you can get materials into cells. Mm-hmm. So this is one area where your DNA-based materials can come in handy. So it turns out if you take short sequences of DNA, mm-hmm. these sequences don't go into cells, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, take a small particle, a nanoparticle, tiny particle, and slap on a bunch of these tiny snippets of DNA on the surface, make it very dense. So now it's going to look kind of like a kush ball with like these DNA sticking out
okay.
all around, right? Yeah. This structure all of a sudden gets into cells in really high quantities. So it can get into cells by up to two orders of magnitude more than regular DNA. So now you can use these not only for treating diseases, but also for detecting various genetic conditions and stuff like that. So my research actually centers on making these kind of structures so that we can detect and treat diseases better.
That's so, so cool. And I believe you're focused a lot on cancer. Is that mm-hmm. true? Okay. And can you go into a little bit more depth on exactly how you're doing it?
Yeah, sure. So we, in general, believe, so let me tell you a little bit about what the broad theme of my lab is, right? So I'm a chemist through and through by training, all the way from undergrad to my postdoc, but I want to do biology with my chemistry knowledge, mm-hmm. right? So when I look at biology as a chemist, what I see is that the human body is made out of trillions of cells. And within each individual cell, you have millions of chemical reactions happening. Right? So there are actually more reactions happening in your body than there are stars in the Milky Way wow. galaxy, right? So as a chemist, what I think is, let's say we can write down every single individual reaction that's happening in your body as series of reactants becoming products.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine you can monitor or detect each of the individual reactants and each of the individual products mm-hmm. related to these reactions. Let's say you can measure or quantify all the reactants and all the products, and you can also change the concentrations or amounts of all the reactants and all the products. Then in principle, you can detect and treat any disease, right? Mm-hmm. Now that sounds super simple, and mm-hmm. obviously it isn't. And the reason it's not as easy is because you really need two things. Mm-hmm. One is you need new methods. These should be methods that allow you to measure different things more accurately, right? Or change the amounts of things more accurately. So when I say measure things, I'm talking about detection platforms. When mm-hmm. I say control the amounts, I'm talking about new kinds of drugs,
mm-hmm.
right? And so you need methods, and you also need new materials, right? Actually, drugs would be the materials that you would use, right? Methods would be like detection platforms, and materials would be drugs kind of things. And for detection also, oftentimes you need new materials so that they can interact with the molecules you are interested in and give you some sort of signal to let you know that what you're looking for is indeed present, right? So our goal is to make these kind of new materials and new methods. Mm-hmm. And this can then be used for, honestly, monitoring any kind of disease. One of the things we focus on now is cancer, and that is because of how important it is and how difficult it is to detect at early stages and how difficult it is to treat in a lot of situations. So that's one of the reasons why we focus on cancer. But in principle, our platforms can be utilized for other diseases like cardiovascular diseases, Alzheimer's, so on and so forth. So some of the things we are trying to do in regards to detecting cancer is we are trying to make materials that would allow you to detect molecules associated with cancer early on.
Okay.
So let me give you a reason why. So let's say somebody has a cancer, some type of tumor in the body.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to do a blood test to figure out if this person has cancer or not, so scientists have estimated that it can take up to 10 years for the cancer to grow to secrete enough stuff into your blood that is detectable.
So
that kind of gives you an idea of how limited our current detection platforms are.
Yeah.
Right? It can take up to 10 years to find out somebody has cancer because you simply can't detect these things, right?
Okay.
And this is not a problem of necessarily only detecting the molecule.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's a problem of you already have that molecule in normal bodies, and so your cancer is not really producing a significantly elevated amount of this molecule, right? So you can have two different kinds of problems. So we are really trying to solve the problem where, what if it is releasing something, but you just can't detect it because it's so small,
mm-hmm.
right? So we are trying to build in amplification schemes into our materials so that we can detect these things at early stages, so that we can have more blood-based detection platforms for cancer.
Okay. And what are the some of the molecules, or like an example of a molecule that you would be detecting early on?
So it turns out that there is a class of molecules called proteases that are highly dysregulated in diseases like cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So proteases are enzymes that chop up other proteins. And one example is when you eat food, there are proteases in your stomach that chop up the food, make it into amino acids that then gets repurposed for making new proteins in your body.
Mm-hmm.
So proteases are basically involved in all kinds of chemical and biological processes, meaning if you have a disease, protease activity is completely goes off, right? So it turns out that when you have cancerous tumors growing in the body, your protease activity also changes. And scientists have shown that if you can detect protease activity, you can detect tumors that are about tenfold smaller than what you can detect by MRI or CT scans.
Wow.
So that's why we think that proteases are really a very cool class of molecules that we should be looking at. And once again, like I said, the next challenge is actually finding things in the blood so that you don't have to take biopsies and such. And so we are trying to make better detection platforms for detecting proteases from cancer.
Okay. That's so, so interesting. And how long have you been working on that?
So we are a very new group at UT Austin.
Mm-hmm.
So we started in 2021. So we are about a year old right now.
Cool. That's awesome. Obviously, this is the research that you're working on now. But what, if any, is the research that you've been a part of that you think is like the most interesting?
Well, actually, so when I was a grad student, there was this one research project that was not my thesis project. That was sort of like a almost a side project that I was working on. And I think what we did there was super cool. So we were just trying to study how chemical reactions work within water droplets, right? So a very fundamental kind of study. And we found something that is really incredible. So many things, like you can have salts and sugar and stuff like that, you know that they're, if you make a solution in water, they're going to be stable for indefinitely, right? Forever, almost, right?
Yeah.
So there are many molecules like that, and they're going to be very stable in water solutions. What we found is if you were to spray water into teeny tiny droplets, then things change completely in these teeny tiny droplets.
Okay.
So by teeny tiny, I mean we have droplets on the order of micrometers in size.
Okay.
And then what we saw is that, first of all, many chemical reactions are accelerated by up to a millionfold, right? So it goes really slowly in like a beaker in bulk water. You make teeny tiny droplets and all of a sudden the same reaction is happening a million times faster, okay? So that was number one. Super awesome, super cool.
Yeah.
Second thing, and this was, I think, really the mind-boggling thing that we saw is, you know, most of us learn from our high school chemistry that if you have oxidation and reduction happening, they need to happen in pairs, right? You can't have oxidation happening without reduction and vice versa. So we put in these salts that are completely stable in water and found that when you spray the water droplets, your stuff starts getting reduced spontaneously, okay? No reducing agent added. And so we were completely stumped. We were like, what is happening here?
Yeah.
And then we figured out that when you're spraying water, water itself becomes redox active. And therefore you start to see these kind of weird chemical reactions. Okay, now why do we care about that? So one of the things we found was that if you can take a bunch of different biomolecules, so molecules that are present in your body, completely stable in water, spray them, and they get reduced, okay? Mm-hmm. Now things start to get interesting. The reason is, if you were to look at the size of the droplets we're studying, they were about 30 microns in diameter. If you were to look at a biological cell is about 30 microns in diameter. And a cell is nothing but 70% made of water. So you can think of it as a crowded micro droplet, mm-hmm. right? So crowded ball of water, right? So this told us that chemical reactions that happen within cells, scientists usually study them by replicating those chemical reactions in the bulk, in a beaker. Mm-hmm. But this tells us that may not be representative of what's happening inside cells. So everything that we know, it's possible that at least some of it might need to be reconsidered or revisited, right? Wow. So that really changes your understanding of all the chemistry that we know about biological processes. So I thought that was super cool and super impactful.
That is so cool. And what questions did it bring up for you and the team in terms of like kind of how to follow up or what to do next?
Yeah, so one of the things that was done after I left the group was trying to figure out what is it about tiny drops of water that's making this happen on a fundamental level, right? How small a droplet do you need? So we were spraying the droplets in air, right? So does it have to be an air-water interface? Can you have like small droplets in oil? And what really causes this, right? Is this the droplets are evaporating, so you have a concentration effect? That's actually not what happens, as we found out, so, which makes it even more cool, right? So we think what's happening is that there's strong electric field at the air-water interface. And this strong electric field is resulting in electrons being stripped off from different molecules or ions. And that's what's driving these weird oxidation reduction events. So that's what we think. But for me personally, what that made me think was that if really this tells us that maybe biological processes happen differently inside cells, because once again, they are small droplets of water, then we really need better ways of looking at reactions in living cells, right? And so that's why a big portion of my lab focuses on making tools that would allow us to do just that, look at things in living cells.
Okay, so basically that like streamlined what you're doing now.
Yeah.
Being part of that. And a quick question as well, when you were saying that interactions are happening a lot faster inside the tiny water droplets versus like a beaker, does that have anything to do with the second thing you were saying about the redox reactions, or was there another reason why they were going so quickly?
The reason for the enhanced reaction?
Yeah.
We don't fully understand it. That's the thing. It completely opens up new lines of investigation. Can all chemical reactions be accelerated? The answer is no. We found that in some cases we see no effect. And in some cases you actually see like retardation, mm-hmm. right? So really it opens up new areas of new lines of questioning, like because there's so much we just don't know about these systems.
Yeah. When it comes to that, obviously you have a lot of questions from this research that you've done. If you had all the funding in the world, like what would be the main questions that you would want to answer? What are the processes specifically that you would want to look at in the human body?
Well, if I had all the funding in the world, I think the most important problem to solve is being able to intercept deleterious biological processes so that you can treat diseases, right? Mm-hmm. So in principle, what I would like to do is I would like to know what every single molecule in your body does and how we can change the chemical reaction it's a part of so that we can design better treatment platforms. That's what I would like to do.
That would be so cool. In general, what is a common misconception about your field of work? or maybe chemistry in general?
I think one of the common misconceptions is that people, I think, have a very archaic notion of what chemistry entails, I would say. And they think it's like inorganic chemistry, organic chemistry, physical chemistry. So like these kind of new interdisciplinary fields like nanoscience, that you can be a chemist who kind of works on making drugs, right? Mm-hmm. Or who works on making better detection platforms. I think a lot of people can't make that connection, that you can be a chemist, but you can be affecting a lot of these areas. And even young students don't really understand that, you know, you can use DNA, which is a biological material, as a material, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that is one common misconception about what chemists do. And I hope that gradually that's going to change.
Yeah, absolutely. What are the fundamental parts of chemistry that you would need to have a really good grasp on in order to do your job?
So one of the things I will say is the kind of research that I work on is very, very interdisciplinary. Mm-hmm. And therefore I have felt a lot of times that it wasn't really necessary, like having a degree, undergrad degree in chemistry, I'm not really sure if that helped me with my research at all. Right. I was just interested in chemistry. That's why I studied undergrad. So what I would say is it is important that no matter what you're working on, your classes will not necessarily help you to gain the fundamental understanding that you need. Mm-hmm. You need to be proactive in finding the information, right, that is necessary for doing well. In the kind of research that I do, once again, I never took biology classes after the 10th grade, okay, right? So all of my knowledge is actually from reading research papers. But now my research uses principles of biochemistry, mm-hmm, enzymology, principles of analytical chemistry, material science, biomedical engineering, all kinds of things. And all of this I've kind of learned from mostly reading papers, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. You said also that you've been in chemistry from the beginning of your undergraduate career. What was it that first sparked your interest?
Well, honestly, there were so many things. It's kind of hard to pinpoint. So one of the reasons I wanted to be a scientist is because of my mom. My mom is a nuclear physicist. And so when I wanted to grow up, I wanted to be just like her. And then when I grew up, I was like, okay, I'm clearly not as smart as she is. So I'm going to, you know, do something that is suitable for me. And chemistry seemed like something I was reasonably good at. And I was like, okay, maybe I can be a chemist. You know, along the process, you know, so because I wanted to be a scientist, you know, I used to watch all kinds of these science-related things would really excite me. One of them was Dexter's Laboratory. This is a cartoon. I don't know if you're familiar with this cartoon.
No.
Yeah, so it was a cartoon, you know, in the 90s. It used to come on. So this cartoon basically follows the life of Dexter, who is a boy genius, and he's like a super genius boy, and his family is a normal family, right? So a lot of times he has a sister, her name is Dee Dee, and he has a secret laboratory in his house where he mixes stuff and there's like explosions and stuff. He's always trying to create and invent new things. And Dee Dee comes and tries to like, you know, mess all of that up. And she's like a, you know, simple child, right? How a child is supposed to be, fun, loving, messing things up. And he's super serious scientist like. So when I saw that, I was like, oh, wow, this mixing things, having explosions sounds kind of cool. So that's something that I wanted to do. And then one of my mother's colleagues, actually, I remember once going into his office and he had these pictures of like these balls, which represented atoms with like sticks connecting them in weird ways. And so I asked him like, you know, what determines, I think I was in probably the 7th grade at the time. So we hadn't really covered principles of chemical bonding at that time, right? I was like, what makes this ball have like three arms, three sticks going in different directions? Why is this one connecting to two? You know, what determines that? And then he told me that in some cases, you know, it's, you know, how many valence electrons that have, obviously he didn't use this term because I was too young to understand that. But basically he said, oh, this is how atoms are. And I was like, I don't understand why And then I would try to make up my own molecules, basically. By connecting different atoms randomly, and I'm okay, this molecule is going to exist. Fortunately, luckily, later when I ended up doing my master's degree under his mentorship. So this was Professor Apuru Jena at Virginia Commonwealth University. And we actually did theoretically conceptualize some new molecules that would have some very interesting properties.
Wow, what a cool full circle moment. That is awesome. So it seems like you really love what you do. Can you tell me your favorite part of your job?
I think the best part of the job is mentoring students. So I'm very excited about science, but it is much more exciting to see this excitement being transferred to my students and exciting other people about it, right? And then we can all just be a group of excited scientists, mad chemists, sort of. I really like the mentoring aspect of my job. Seeing students coming in and they're so scared. They're like, oh, I've never worked on what you do before. I'm like, don't worry, neither did I. You know, yeah. I'm learning. Everything that I know now, I've learned. I didn't learn this about this in class. I learned by myself, and you can too. The most important thing is you want to learn, right? Mm-hmm. You know, then seeing these graduate students right now, as I said, I just finished my first year. So when my students came in, they had zero background in what we do in the lab. And now watching them grow in this last year, like, they have made such incredible progress. And now that we have incoming first years, they're the ones who are kind of mentoring them. It is so, so satisfying to see this sort of transition in them. It's really awesome.
That's amazing. Is there anything that they've done or worked on that you think is particularly exciting?
There are so many things that they have done, but I would not like to talk about it unless it's published.
Fair.
But yeah, they're doing some really cool stuff. Stay tuned.
Cool. In the works. And what would you say is the most difficult part of your job?
Managing time, I would say. So one of the things that school, like regular training, like undergrad, PhD, postdoc, whatever, trains you really well is being a scientist, right? So you get really good training on how to think about solving different problems, how to do research. So, you know, when you don't have resources, right? I didn't learn things in class. So how do you go and find the information that you need, how to think about problems and all of that? So all of this period, I was solely focused on how to make myself a better scientist. Mm-hmm. But then the moment you become a professor and you get the job that I have, and honestly, I should have realized it. I just never thought about it this way. Your job is very, very different. It is no longer about just being a good scientist. It is so much more about managing people, about teaching others. So a big part of my job is teaching undergrad classes. So fundamentals of chemistry, teaching that. Big part of my job is teaching my graduate students how to do research and then mentoring them. Big part of my job is actually getting other people excited about what we do so that we can bring in more grants and funding to carry on our research. And then I think the other big part of what I think is a really big part of our job is outreach, right? Letting other people know this is what we do and reaching out to not only people who give us money, but also the general population, like younger students, and get them excited in science and telling the general mass that your tax dollars are going to good use, right? So there are so many different things, so many different hats you have to wear as a professor. It is so different from just being the idea that people have of scientists. I think this is actually another misconception perhaps people have about scientists in general, that they're like these weird people who like to stick to themselves, but that just doesn't work. Scientists have to be social to talk to other people, and at least good scientists have to be that way, you know, so that you can let people know about the cool things that you're doing and keep things moving forward.
Absolutely. What is a typical day in your life?
So I think the typical day in my life right now looks very different from what it might look in a few years from now. Okay. Right now, like I said, because I'm just starting, so it's exactly like starting a new company, right? So you have to get funding, you have to get people. So right now it looks really busy. So most of the day I'm working either on preparing class notes for my classes,
mm-hmm.
or writing grants or writing papers or talking to students or being in lab and trying to run experiments, showing students how to do things. And then when I get home, it's more of the same. So right now it looks like this. But I think that is going to change significantly once we have sort of established ourselves a little bit more. But the, you know, and I know that, you know, other people might be hearing this and they might be thinking, oh my God, why would I ever want a life like that? Well, I'll tell you why, because over the past 1.5 years, it's been pretty crazy. The workload has been insane. Like I said, managing time is hard, but I've loved every single moment of it. And the best part is I do things that I want to do. Mm-hmm. Right. I don't do things because I have to do them anymore. So I don't think this has ever been the case in my entire life so far, where I literally can do whatever I want whenever I want, right? Except showing up to class on time, because yeah. that's kind of set. Everything else that I do on my own time. And I do things because I want to do them. Nobody's telling me you have to apply for this grant. I decide what grant I want to apply for and whatnot. So I think it's been absolutely fantastic.
That is amazing. Yeah, you kind of get to choose your own path every day when it comes mm-hmm. to stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. You can also choose your own hours when you can manage time well.
Yeah, but these days they're very long for you.
Yes.
generally, I have found, and kind of the general consensus is that chemistry curriculum as it is now is pretty outdated and maybe mm-hmm. not taught in a way that is inspiring to students or really kind of getting the most out of chemistry that you could. And mm-hmm. being a professor yourself, do you have any ideas as to, like, on the high school level, for the mm-hmm. younger level, because these are students that aren't interested in chemistry yet, right? Like the ones you mm-hmm. work with know that they want to do this, but mm-hmm. how would you kind of revitalize that curriculum to get more people interested in chemistry?
Yeah. So I think one of the things I will say is that, I think some of the stuff that we do learn in undergrad or in high school, that is not things that we do now. It is outdated, but I think without the fundamental understanding of that, I think it's going to be really hard. Some of that you really need a fundamental grasp on, right? So that part needs to be there. But in terms of, so I can tell you, I don't know how things are done now in high school, mm-hmm. But I remember when I was in high school, we had to learn metallurgy. Like, we just had to memorize tons of chemical equations on how you can extract metals. And I was like, I don't care about this. Why do I need to memorize? If I wanted to find out how to do it, I would just look it up somewhere. Right. But, you know, that was, I don't know, like 15 years ago at this point. So things probably have changed a lot. But what I think, what I see these days is I see high school students who are involved in research. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the ways of revitalizing, your high school curriculum or undergrad curriculum is basically letting them know that there is this modern area of chemistry and people can do research in it. And I think UT does a fabulous job of that. So that's my college, UT Austin. We actually have this initiative called Freshman Research Initiative, where freshmen, incoming first year undergrads, can actually be in a research lab and work on their own projects, right? So I think, like, we are already making some headway in that sort of terms. And then one of the things that we can do as scientists, once again, is go to different high schools, middle schools, or even elementary schools, and show people what chemistry can do. Show them that chemistry can be fun, like do like science demonstrations and stuff, right? And then if they get interested, they can then participate in like some summer science camps and stuff like that, to kind of explore whether they really like the subject or not. So I think these are some of the things that can be done. And we are actively doing things like that. I am actively trying to do things like this as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think too, part of what you were saying with bringing the freshmen in to kind of be able to work on their own projects comes from looking at the bigger picture, because chemistry mm-hmm. can get so small and you can mm-hmm. kind of get lost in like, why is this important? Or like, you know, how does this connect? And so by focusing on the bigger, broader concepts and then working down into the smaller stuff, I think it can really give people an idea of, you know, what this part of science really can do. Because
that is absolutely correct.
Yeah.
I think you brought up a really good point. You know, as a student, sometimes I felt that I learned different concepts, but I couldn't really see the connection, the thread that's connecting all of them, right? So it was really like disparate collection of ideas and not like one coherent story. Mm-hmm. And I think now as a teacher, I can tell you that giving this coherent story, like telling this to students, is really hard. Mm-hmm. You know, it's actually a really hard thing to do. But I think it is important. It's an important thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. If someone was aspiring to do your job, what is the level of knowledge that they would need to have? What are the degrees they would need to have? And in addition to that, what is your educational background? And what did you get your degrees in? Where did you get them? All of that.
Okay, so I will start with what you need to have. So if you want to be a professor, so as a faculty at UT Austin, one of my main jobs is to teach undergraduates and graduate students. Mm-hmm. And my other central job is that I lead a research laboratory, right? And to be able to have this job, you need to have a PhD mm-hmm. in a related area and preferably some sort of postdoctoral experience. So postdoctoral experience is once you have your PhD, you're still in a mentored research state, but you're more independent than you were as a PhD student, or at least that's the idea in principle. So it is a substantial amount of training after undergrad. So after undergrad, it's at least 5 years of PhD or so. That's roughly an estimate. And in my case, it was 4 years of postdoc. This varies. It can go from 2 years to 6 years. And there is no time limit. Same with PhD. There is no time limit. So for some people can do a PhD in 3 years. Some people can, it takes them 7 years, depending on their project. But I think 5 years is the average time for a PhD. For postdoc, I would say in chemistry, average time would be somewhere in the 3 to 4 year range.
Okay.
In terms of what my degrees are and where I got trained. So I grew up in India in a city called Kolkata, which is called the City of Joy. And I went to St. Xavier's College, Kolkata. That's where I got my undergraduate degree from. Okay. Then I came to the US and I got my master's from Virginia Commonwealth University, which is where I worked with Professor Puru Jena. Mm-hmm. After that, I went to Stanford University, where I got my PhD in chemistry. And then from Stanford, where I worked with Professor Richard Zare. And then from Stanford, I went to Northwestern University, where I was a postdoctoral fellow in Professor Chad Merkin's group, before finally coming to UT Austin as an assistant professor of chemistry.
Cool. So it takes a lot of work.
It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of time. Yeah. Yes. And it takes a lot of dedication. It takes years of training. And this training, you know, learning about chemistry is a very small part of the training. Majority of the training that you get through this many years is how to communicate both orally and in writing, how to problem solve, how to think about new problems, right? As scientists, sometimes nobody tells you this is a problem, mm-hmm. right? You have to be like, okay, so I see this, but I think it can be made better. So you have to identify the problems in some cases, right? Identifying problems and then figuring out why some people, a problem that may not have been solved for eternity, and then you need to figure out a way to solve it, right? So learning how to do that, I think, is the main thing you learn. You know, the actual area, like whether it's chemistry or biology, that's a very small component, because at least at this level, at my level right now, the research I do, once again, I mean, it's very interdisciplinary. So the lines are very blurry. What I do is very blurry. It's not just chemistry.
Yeah. And so you had mentioned about like having to problem solve and be really good mm-hmm. with that. So yeah. what is the most important personality trait or the strength that someone would need in order to fulfill that?
Persistence, mm-hmm. not giving up. So just to tell you a little bit about my personal story. So I think most people will probably relate to this, right? So I think I was a relatively good student, right? And when you're a good student, you're really focused on getting your A's.
Yeah.
Right? That's kind of what your focus is. And you want to do well at whatever comes your way, right? But after a certain point, especially when you do research, there is no numerical metric to judge how well you're doing, right? The number of papers you publish doesn't really tell you if you're doing good work, right? So it's a very subjective metric at that point. So all of a sudden you're like, okay, I don't know if I'm doing well or not, right? Mm-hmm. So now from being an A student, when I went to my master's, and then I was working on computational chemistry. And I think for my master's, I published 8 papers and I thought, oh my God, you know, I'm doing so well. I have a very bright future ahead of me. Mm-hmm. And then when I went in to do my PhD at Stanford, I thought that, okay, I think I want to change to experiments because I really want to do things with my hands and I want things to have like a more tangible effect on the world, right? Yeah. And so then I started to do experiments and nothing I touched worked, mm-hmm. nothing. And I was like, oh my God, I am a terrible experimentalist. Anything and everything that I do failed. And this went on for more than 2 years, constantly, every single day. And it is so demoralizing, right? So from being like this A student who has so many papers coming in and failing every single day, complete shock. But I was like, you know what? And I'm not going to let this stop me. I'm just going to keep pushing. And then finally, I think at some point in my third year, I started getting a publication. And then from there, I started building momentum, yeah. right? So I think this is something that almost any scientist will tell you, that your job, you're not doing your job right unless you're failing 90% of the time. Sometimes it's 99% of the time. And that's in every aspect. That's when you write for grants, you're probably going to get 10% of the grants that you write. Mm-hmm. You're going to get rejections when you submit papers. Some people will say this is a terrible paper. Somebody else will say the same paper is awesome, right? So it becomes very, very subjective. So learning how to deal with rejection and being persistent, these are the two key traits that'll keep you moving. And personally, I think what helps this whole thing is if you really, really are enthusiastic about what you're doing, you know? So, sure. And you need to know that things will work out at the end. You need to have that hope. That's important.
Absolutely. That's the persistence is very important. who in the field of chemistry is someone that you really look up to and that you're just really in awe of?
There are so many people that I look up to in chemistry. Honestly, it's hard to pinpoint just one person. I will say that my advisors, you know, and have really, really impacted me deeply in how I approach science. And, you know, that's why I chose to work with them, because they were really inspiring figures. And I've learned different things from different advisors, right? I think a lot of my advising, the way I advise students, the way I approach problems is inspired by my PhD advisor, you know? And I think like, so I remember when I was applying, when I was just a first year grad student, I wanted to talk to different professors and figure out what might be a good fit for me. And some professors said, you're not a good fit for my lab, without even meeting me. They looked at my CV and they're like, you're not a good fit for my lab because I did computation and they were doing experiments. And I'm like, I'm a first year. I'm here to learn. How can I not be a good fit for your lab? That just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
Right. So when I talked to my advisor, the first time I met him, he talked to me very briefly. And he said, the sooner you join, the sooner you get lab space. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, wow. So that's what I tell my students. I don't care what your background is. As long as you're willing to learn, I think you're going to do well. And they do. I mean, so far they've been doing well. So I think my advisor really impacted me deeply. And then in terms of, you know, managing groups, people, being able to present your work to different types of audiences, these kind of things, I again learned from my postdoctoral advisor, you know, how to excite people about what you're doing. Talk about it with enthusiasm, but not oversell the results that you have, you know, keep yourself grounded. I think these are the kind of things I learned from my postdoc advisor. So I really look up to those people.
Lastly, is there anything that you wish I asked you that I didn't?
No, not really. I think you asked me all the important things.
Okay. Well then, thank you so much. Thank you so much for listening to the Chem Talk podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure to check out all of our articles in general, organic, and biochemistry at www.chemistrytalk.org.